This is the Lou Rockwell Show.
It's great to have on the show today Dr. Guido Holzmann. Guido is a senior fellow at the Mises Institute. He's chairman of the economics department and holds a chair himself at the University of Angers in France. Author of 5 books, the most recent one, the magisterial biography of Ludwig von Mises, called Mises, The Last Night of Liberalism, which I very, very highly recommend. I also highly recommend his forthcoming book on the ethics of money production. And Guido, speaking about the ethics of money production, in the U.S. anyway, ever since the evil day of August 15, 1971, when Richard Nixon repudiated the federal government's promise to pay gold to foreign holders of dollars, we've been on a purely discretionary fiat paper money system. What have the effects of that been?
Well, the immediate effect is a technical one. Now the central bank is free to produce as much paper notes and as many electronic entries in its accounts, that is called a central bank liquidities, as it wishes. It is no more bound by any technological constraints because obviously these kind of things can be produced at very low cost and by rather primitive means. And it is no longer constrained by any economic limitation. In a usual business, you cannot just indefinitely expand the production of your product because cost of production will simply outrun the additional revenue stream that you generate. But a central bank can produce a $100 bill, an additional $100 bill, just with a little slip of paper and some more ink. And as I always tell my students in my classes, they wouldn't even need more paper. They could just take a little bit more ink and add a zero to the existing 100 on the paper note, and they could produce very easily $1,000 notes. So that's the immediate impact. And as a consequence, we have all kinds of negative repercussions on the market. At first glance, it seems that that's a very good thing because now the central bank can solve any kind of problems because it can produce just as much money as it wishes. But the problem is that the market participants react to this paradisic condition. And they now start behaving as if they had the big brother always behind them, watching that nothing goes sour. To give you a comparison or an example, an illustration, imagine that you have a circus, and you have artists balancing on a high wire. Now, the kind of pirouettes that they will make, the kind of show things, will, of course, differ vastly depending on whether there is a rescue net below them or not. If there's no rescue net below them, you will just see them wandering very carefully over the high wire and watch their steps and so on. And as soon as there is a safety net below them, they will make saltos and turn and various other things. So they will run much more risk. Now, that's exactly what financial market participants do in the presence of a central bank that can produce a paper money. They start doing all kinds of risky things because they know the central bank is there to save them if things turn sour. So two things they do in particular. One is to neglect the risk side of their investment and only look on the possible earnings. And the second thing that's probably even more fatal is that they pursue a debt-based investment strategy. That is, their investments are no longer financed predominantly out of equity, but out of debt. And this is individually absolutely irrational, but of course the financial market as a whole becomes much more fragile. And therefore, the longer you pursue such a strategy and the lower the equity ratios become, the smaller needs to be the initial difficulty that presents itself that disturbs the smooth run of things and creates a snowball effect that can draw the entire financial markets down with them. And that's exactly what we are witnessing today.
You know, some of these investment banks were leveraged 40 to 1. That's not much equity.
No, that's not much equity. Louis, in the 19th century, before the central banks came into full swing, the first central bank that we had was the Bank of England, and then the other countries established central banks a few decades after this. The last great nation was the U.S., which established a central bank in 1913. Before that, banks in general, whatever the business model, whether it was a universal bank or investment bank, a deposit bank, and so on, operated on fairly high equity ratios. So it was at least 50% or so, and it was very rare that they went below this. And that's natural. Equity is the cushion that that keeps you in business when things turn not as you speculated that they would, not as you hoped that they would. But of course, then if you start running down your equity because you earn more money doing this, you become vulnerable. And if everybody does this, then the market as a whole becomes vulnerable. That's what we observe today. But it's good that you mentioned this, right? I mean, this increasing fragility of the market is not something that happened in the past 5 years. It's not even something that happened only in the past 30 years, ever since we had paper money. It's something that is a secular movement that can be traced back to the 19th century, starting from the inception of central banks. The other participants of the financial markets have adapted and increasingly reduced their equity.
You know, Andrew Jackson famously called the central bank of his day the monster. That's right, isn't it? I mean, these things really are monsters.
They are, right? And few people, unfortunately, understand why, and that's why the Mises Institute plays such an important role in your website and in communicating these ideas that are actually not new. Right? The basic analysis of central banking has not changed in the past 150 to 200 years. It's just that they are not taught. I mean, our universities, unfortunately, are usually mute about these things. And I think the first thing that would need to be taught are the redistribution effects that follow from the production of paper money. As we have learned from Richard Cantillon, which is an Irish-French banker and economist of the early 18th century, any new production of money has its impact on prices not immediately, so not all prices increase at the same time and to the same extent, but in a process that is spread out in time. So certain prices rise first, and then other prices come next, and so on. Now, this means that the revenue, the monetary revenue of some people will increase rather quickly, whereas the prices have not yet all prices have adapted, which means in turn that their real revenue increases. Whereas on the other hand, there are people who already have to pay higher prices for all the goods that they consume, whereas their monetary revenue has not yet adjusted. So there is a redistribution process necessarily springing from the production of money. And it benefits the first users of the new money and goes to the detriment of the last users of the new money. Now, of course, in our day, the first users of the new money are always the financial markets, because that's where central banks sell their product. And in the second line, the government, which is equipped with new credit through the financial markets.
You know, this is clearly a process of theft. I mean, isn't there a moral issue involved as well as bad economics?
Yeah, absolutely. I think so, too. And this theft comes from the way that people have no choice in their currency. I mean, this redistribution process occurs, of course, even if you have free market money, right? Let's say if you have a gold standard or a silver standard, and there would be then gold mining and silver mining, and each new production of additional gold ounces and silver ounces would entail a similar redistribution process. But that is, of course, constrained by competition within the market. A money that would be produced at a rate that is too quick and which would entail a rundown of the purchasing power per unit and entail huge redistribution would be quickly abandoned by the market participants. But that's today not possible. That's precisely the problem with our paper money. It's not freely chosen by the consumers, but it's imposed on the market. So even if it creates these detrimental effects to the great majority, there's no way we can get rid of it, because the government forces us to accept it through legal tender laws.
Guido, what would a sound money system look like if we were to establish one?
Well, I mean, a sound money system must rely on the freedom of choice of producers and the freedom of choice of consumers. That's the best safeguard. It's very difficult to design a priori the best institutions should be in competition. And again, well, if history is any guide, and if our theoretical insights, the few that we have about this issue, are any guides, I would say that we should expect a natural money system, or an ideal money system, to feature metallic money, such as silver in particular, and also gold, copper, and similar metals. And that's simply because by their physical qualities, they are most appropriate to be used in monetary exchanges, and because there's no better alternative available right now.
Guido, I can't thank you enough for coming on and talking to us about these issues, and I hope you'll come back.
With great pleasure, Lou.
Thank you, Dr. Guido Holzmann.
You've been listening to The Lou Rockwell Show. Produced by LouRockwell.com, the best-read libertarian website in the world. If you'd like to advertise on this podcast or on the website, email advertise@LouRockwell.com. And thanks for listening.